WS2N. Call and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letter and name at this time. K2RIW.
Dick, WA2CDL, it's 7 o'clock, 7:04. It's not 8:04 at this time. WA2CDL?
My goodness. I looked at my watch the wrong way. Well, how about that? And I did a mad rush to get here in time. Good thing you brought that to my attention, Andy. Thank you, and I'll be standing by. I think this is the first. What do you think?
I'm here with Eric. We're doing some work. And I said to myself, I just heard you, I had the radio on in my car, and I said, wait a minute, it's not the net time. First of all, I looked at the sun, and I used my sundial, and I see how high the sun is in the sky, and I'm saying, wow, if it's 8 o'clock, then we got a problem.
Good evening. K2RIW here, again. For those who listened at around 7 o'clock, I thought it was 8 o'clock. Did my whole preamble at 8 o'clock. You guys missed it. I'm saying that, no, K2KEY and Dick are going to run the second half. Now, we still are. And now we're doing it at 8 o'clock. This is second half number 1,193. And the second start because of my confusion of time. A person signs into the second net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and that yes or no, which means you do have a question or a comment in the net. So do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
Me into ROI, Joe. No questions right now.
Bet you'll have a question a little bit later. Joe recognized. Haven't heard Paul, Rich, or Mel yet, but I guess I will. Heard Andy earlier. As I said, I made the mistake earlier of signing in at 7 o'clock and thinking it was 8 o'clock. Please give me a call letters right now if you want to check into the TechNet. K2RIW listening. Okay, I heard both KE2EJ and Paul WS2N. Simultaneously, which is what Andy was discussing earlier. It was you volunteering, is that true, Eric?
No, it was someone else.
Okay, who is the other person besides Paul?
M2EO, no question.
Okay, Whitestone with no question. How about that? Okay, so far we've got Joe, Rich, Eric, Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name.
KE2EC. Name is Rich, no questions right now.
First.
K2SKE, Myers, no question.
And good evening all, this is K2KEY.
Okay, lots of people signing in. Nobody with any questions though. Myers, Rich, Eric, Joe, Andy, another Rich, Mel, Paul, and anyone else with any questions, give me your call letters and name.
I have a question for you.
Eric recognized. Anyone else?
Yeah, W2RIY. Actually, I do have one. I'll ask you. Put me in order also.
Okay, we got Eric and Joe in that order. Anyone else? You're allowed to change your name. Now change your status.
C2TMD Vinny. No questions at this time.
K2KYQ. Yes, I have questions.
And Mr. KYQ, what is your name, sir?
Sorry about that. Handle is Joe.
Is that Joe, J-O-E?
That is correct.
Okay, we got you, Joe, as well as Vinny. All right, Eric was the first one with a real question. And he's also going to bring us up to speed on what's going on with high-def television, digital television. K2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Hi, K2RIW, K2K. I've been thinking about a particular project. I have a concept in mind, and it reminds me of a VOR station. Now, VOR station, the principle of the way that works is, well, why don't you explain it to me, and we'll go from there, Dick.
Alrighty, my understanding of VOR, which stands for VHF Omnidirectional Ranging Station, these things have been around for lots and lots of years. I'm guessing they started in the late 40s, early 50s. The Federal Aviation Administration has stations, quite a number of them, around the United States for sure. If you ever get a aeronautical section chart, you'll see each of these circular areas indicated with three-letter call letters alongside of them. TPK, for instance, is the one that's mounted, located in Deer Park. So all between 108 and 118 megacycles, the station transmits a kind of a complicated signal. It is a signal that is both FM modulated and amplitude modulated, but the FM modulation and amplitude modulation are not done in sequence. By that I mean the FM modulation, I think, is the one that is sent out omnidirectionally. The antenna pattern is controlled by a whole series of individual antennas fed by something similar to a goniometer. That's a fancy way of saying you got a whole lot of antennas that are, in my example, it's make-believe you've got a great big clock on the ground, top view, and the clock is all 100 feet in diameter. And at 1 o'clock, you've got an antenna. At 2 o'clock, you've got an antenna. At 3 o'clock, you've got an antenna, and so on. So at each instant of time, you choose which antenna you're going to be transmitting from. Therefore, a person off at a particular azimuth angle, like a person who's due north, will see the strongest signal during the time that the antenna at 12 o'clock is transmitting, and that corresponds to a FM transmission that's taking place simultaneously. So the receiver has got both an FM and an AM demodulator, and it compares the phase between the two. So depending the phase on the amplitude modulation versus the phase of the FM modulation, your receiver then says, aha, you are X number of degrees away from that station. And you can adjust the receiver so that it tells you how many degrees you must fly to go towards the station, or how many degrees you must fly to go away from the station. You can adjust it either way. And the earlier receivers had a dial that you would twist, and you would center tune a Dawson dial movement. I think the more modern ones probably are thoroughly automatic. So these stations will tell you what is the direction, the compass heading that you are from that station. And if you, if you don't know where you are, but you know you're in the vicinity of these two particular VOR stations, and you measure the angle you are from each of those two stations, and you plot those angles on a map where the two lines that you draw cross, in theory, that's where you are. So it's a very nice locating system. Near each of the airports, they usually try to have at least one of those VOR stations. So I wonder if that's approximately your understanding of how a VOR station works and how the receiver works. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This DPZ with comment.
Mr. DPZ, start off with your name, sir, and then your comment.
It's Al, K6DPZ. The VOR station uses 9960 FM modulated by a 30-cycle rate. And you're right on everything, Dick. You have two 30-cycle phase signals, which, depending on the location, you detect the phase difference. That's the only comment I wanted to make, Dick. Everything else was very good.
Okay, you said something about 9966. That went by so fast, I didn't know what it was. Try that one again, Hal.
Yeah, Dick, it's 9960. It's a signal of 9960 FM modulated at 30 cycles, but they transmit a 9960 signal.
You're probably talking about Deer Park. Each individual station has its own frequency. Isn't that true, Hal?
That's the RF frequency, 9960 kilohertz, though, is the frequency they're using FM modulated that the VOR receiver receives to get its 30-cycle reference signal. You have a variable and a reference. So the 9960 is a tone, which is frequency modulated at a 30 cycle rate.
Gotcha. 9960 hertz. Are you calling that a subcarrier, and there's a 30 hertz modulation on that? Is that what you're saying, Hal?
Right. Yeah, it's really a carrier above the audio frequency, but that's it. It's a basic 9960 FM modulated at 30 cycles.
Okay. So, are you trying to do some direction finding? And this, you would do this by, it is truly triangulation, not trilateration. You could say that the direction finding or the positioning that takes place by a global positioning satellite system is not triangulation, it's trilateration. Literally measuring the distance between multiple satellites in order to figure out where you are on the Earth. But this is triangulation. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the tech net.
Alright, K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, let's talk about the design of that antenna system. Okay? Well, we don't have to get into the intricacies of how you actually find a angular value from phase difference. It's not where I'm going. But let's talk about how you create that antenna structure of the series of dipoles around this disk.
Okay. You could, if you want to, do it electronically or mechanically. Mechanically, it would be a kind of a goniometer. In other words, I could have a kind of a cavity structure. I could have in that cavity structure a bunch of individual probes around the perimeter of the cavity. I could have a emitting structure in the cavity, and I rotate the emitting structure, and as it comes closer to each one of the probes, it maximizes the signal to that particular antenna. That's kind of a goniometer. And if you look up the word goniometer in Google and a number of other good books, you'll find out how it works. That's the way you would do it mechanically. Electronically, to decide what amplitude and what phase angle you're going to send to a bunch of antennas with modern-day electronics where you've got individual vector modulators, which are usually done with a doubly balanced mixer and an IMQ commanding signal going into the doubly balanced mixer, deciding that this particular antenna or this instant of time is going to get a signal at half amplitude at 30 degrees of delay, and the next antenna is going to get full amplitude at 0 degrees of delay. To do that electronically is fairly easy. So I wonder if that's sort of what you're asking, Eric, go ahead.
Kind of, sort of. If you look at the design of the actual antenna array, it looks like there's a cone in there. And I'm under the assumption, I could be wrong, that you think of each dipole as a director, and that cone directly behind it is a reflector. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does, but there's something bothering me about that. When I look at a VOR station, the total diameter of the emitting array is so large that that cone in the center, I'm having trouble believing that it is a common reflector. What I think is being done is that I think multiple elements of this conformal array are being used as a phased array. In other words, if I've got a bunch of emitting elements mounted in a circular pattern, and if I'm smart enough in the way I feed those elements, I'm not dependent on the diameter at all. I could make a small diameter array of all those elements or a large diameter array of all those elements. The advantage of the larger array is that at any one instant of time, I'm going to feed a larger number of them. Therefore, I can get a pencil beam in space that is more narrow and it sweeps an azimuth. So, depending on the diameter and the way I feed the multiple elements, as a moving signal phased array, I can now determine the beam width that I'm transmitting as it sweeps an azimuth. I wonder if that makes some sense, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, yes it does. K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, let me tell you why I'm thinking about this. Let us assume, because I'm looking for an antenna design, really. Let us assume that we have something that's 360 degrees, and that every 10 degrees there is, let's say, a 3 or 5 element beam on. For the argument's sake, 2 meters. And we set this up around the pole, and we used a little diode switching to connect each antenna. It goes into a receiver, which then develops an AGC voltage based upon signal strength. We're not doing anything fancy like phase measurements because we just want to try and figure out with a little computer where the maximum signal strength is. Now, if I put 3 or 4 of these receiving stations at various different locations and I collect the data from each one, was that I'm at station A, I'm receiving a signal, say, at 0 degrees, at its maximum point. So you've got to be a little smart here because you're not going to try and... We're going to try and create an array that has really good isolation for its position sitting at 10 degrees so that there is a significant shift in signal level as you go from array to array. And, you know, we're not talking any kind of Doppler stuff here, so don't get the wrong idea. Let me let this up. Alright, and basically we're going to retrieve the data from these 3 stations and do a little basic trigonometry. And we're going to create a series of vectors that emanate from each station electronically on a map. And at the point that they cross, will be a source of RF. How would you go about approaching designing an antenna to, or rather an array of antennas to maximize this concept? K2RWK 3J.
Yeah, when you get a hold of a really good book, and I'm trying to think of probably Introduction to Radar by Skolnick will have it. The Radar Handbook by Skolnick will have a good section on automatic direction finding systems. I think the latest Antenna Engineering Handbook will have direction finding systems. There are about 5 major concepts. One of the concepts is called simultaneous amplitude comparison. In the most elegant approach, you would have every 10 degrees you've got a Yagi, therefore you've got 36 of these Yagis, and if this was an elegant approach, you would have 36 individual receivers, and you would compare the amplitude between them. The advantage of the simultaneous amplitude comparison is that very, very brief signals can properly be direction found with a simultaneous amplitude comparison system. As long as you've got reason to believe the signals you're looking for are not a very brief pulse, but there's something that's going to be on the air for a period of time, instead of having 36 receivers connected to the 36 antennas, you could have one receiver that you sequentially connect to each of those antennas. You could do it in a severe manner by having an on-off switch, a single pole, 36 pole switch, or you can have it a more gentle procedure by which there's some kind of an amplitude control, although the equivalent of a volume control. You slowly turn up the volume on antenna number 2 as you slowly decrease the amplitude on antenna number 1. Now you've got a system which is giving you amplitude modulation at whatever your scan rate is, your electronic rate at which you go around your 36 antennas in my example. I'm going to call that the scan rate. And you can set things up in a gentle kind of connect and disconnect so that you're not creating glitches into the receiver. And you get a nice smooth amplitude modulation. And by the timing of the amplitude modulation compared to the phasing of the scanning of your receivers, you now determine the best direction of arrival. It's a somewhat more elaborate technique than Doppler scan. You're about to ask me, is it going to be less ambiguous? I mean, a properly deployed Doppler scan for direction finding and a properly deployed amplitude comparison technique, if I had to say, with really good deployment, which one is better, that would be a tough choice. Another kind of amplitude comparison is called time difference of arrival. Great for pulsed systems, for a continuous system, not so great. So I think you see where I'm going with this one, Eric. Maybe that's going to give you some ideas for some more questions. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. I'm sorry, I think I'm in a noisy spot at the moment, but you've given me some food for thought, and actually, if you can run the name of that the gentleman and the name of the book again, that would be some interesting reading for me.
Yeah, when it comes to automatic direction finding, the two books that I would go to are Skolnick, S-K-O-L-N-I-K, Skolnick, Introduction to Radar, Introduction to Radar Systems, or I think it's just called the Radar Handbook. Yeah, he's got a book called Introduction to Radar Systems. He's got a much fatter book, a big red book called the Radar Handbook, but both of them by Skolnick. That's one good book. And then any of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, particularly the more modern ones. Volakis is the author of the most modern one, I think it's the fourth edition, or is it the fifth edition? Before that it was Johnson, R.C. Johnson. Before that it was Jasek and Johnson, and then the earlier version it was Jasek. But Antenna Engineering Handbook is going to have a lot of information on automatic direction finding systems. Skolnick, I think, is going to have more of it, though. Radar Handbook. As I said, there are about five major schemes for direction finding. Simultaneous amplitude comparison, phase comparison techniques, time difference of arrival, and there's also a kind of a double-dual interferometer technique that was really promulgated by the Naval Research Laboratory, which properly deployed that system to keep 1 degree accuracy with near 100% probability of intercept. When you have scanning systems, you have to worry about the fact that while the antenna is scanning by the signal, if the signal is intermittent, it may not be there during the time that you're scanning. Whereas with the simultaneous amplitude comparison system, you miss nothing. That's the bad news. Good news. The bad news is you got to have a whole lot of simultaneous receivers. Well, now the simultaneous receivers could be one single receiver that sequentially goes through all the antennas, and you could sequentially go through all the antennas at a slow rate, or you could sequentially go through all the antennas at a super fast rate, like in nanoseconds. So therefore, in theory, with one receiver channel, you can have high probability of intercept of even a brief pulse signal. But you pay the price there also. Because now you're dwelling on the active channel so briefly, your sensitivity is going to suffer a little bit. If you're sure that the signal you're listening to is strong enough, that may be a good enough system. You got a good question there. It's something that a lot of people have put a lot of brain power in over the last 30 or so years. Many military systems, one of the first pieces of information you want is what is the angle of arrival of that unknown signal so that I can start identifying it, so I can start locating it. As I fly my airplane over that territory, I want to have an accurate playback of the angles versus time versus my location as I flew my airplane. And I put that all together. If I put that together correctly, I can locate that emitter on the ground within a very small number of feet or meters. And therefore, that could, in some scenarios, be a very valuable piece of information. Okay, Eric, we'll probably be coming back to you with that one on future weeks. That's the next person who signed in was Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y. Joe, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RYW in the Texas.
Good evening, Jake. This is K2KYQ. Cell phone. You talked about cell phones a while ago, and the other night, sitting up late at night, I listened in on one of these talk shows where they discussed cell phones and the effect that they're having on causing brain tumors and all sorts of problems. And in the process of all this, they talked about also the microwave oven and the fact that it's apparently when you heat your food up in the oven, it actually, the molecular structure of the food undergoes a change, and that causes problems. Anyhow, I carry a cell phone all the time, and I must admit, after listening to this talk, I'm still carrying it as an emergency device. I keep it turned off. And what is what is the safety aspect of being in a low-powered radiation field, a constant low-powered radiation field, like a cell phone hanging off your belt? And does it help if you use a headset cell phone? The gentleman indicated that sometimes, depending upon the angle of the wire off the cell phone, the wire becomes an antenna and it moves the power, and now you're getting, you're getting more power into your brain area. And I don't know, it's like I got all these questions in my head. And the last part of that thing would be, what about the Wi-Fi that we have? I have my Wi-Fi on all the time at my house. I can get up in the middle of the night, flip up to the computer and start working it because I leave it on. Are we sitting in a radiation pattern that could be causing the problem? You take a break at it. You're out there listening to it. It's okay with you.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Hey, Joe. What we're discovering now is that all of these things are creating cancers at an extremely high rate. You better stop using them. We better give up ham radio. Stand by now, Joe. That was a pure joke. And maybe it's a sick joke. The real problem here of what's called radio frequency biohazard, 90% of the problem, in my opinion, is a problem of vocabulary. In around 1910, 1915, when people started studying wireless and radio, you realize that the antenna, getting a transmitter signal to it, the signal gets emitted in all directions at once from simple antenna. It radiates all directions. So therefore, the radio signal was called radiation. And it was an RF signal, radio frequency signal, so we called it radio frequency radiation, RF radiation. Good set of words from 1915 up until approximately 1940. All of a sudden, in 1940, we have nuclear radiation because we have atomic bombs. We have Hiroshima and Nagasaki and A-bombs and H-bombs and whatever. And now nuclear radiation comes along and people say, hey, radiation is radiation. RF radiation, can that be as bad as nuclear radiation? Same kind of word. And the answer is absolutely not. You're comparing, you're not comparing an apple and an orange. You're comparing the Earth to a dime. Very little comparison between the two, even though they have a common word. In the case of nuclear, each of the particles that come out of a nuclear event have a tremendous amount of energy. Each individual alpha, beta, gamma particle in some circumstances with nuclear has enough energy that when it strikes your body, it is capable of doing cellular damage. It is capable of disturbing your DNA. It is capable of making cells go haywire and possibly become cancerous. Until you get to a frequency that is approximately optical and above, and nuclear radiation is above, all far infrared, near infrared, and red optical, so to speak, is non-ionizing. In other words, each individual photon has too little energy to disturb biological material, with an exception. And that is, anything that's safe, used to an extreme, can become dangerous. Let me drop. At one time, among college students, there was a competitive event of who could consume the most amount of clear, clean water in 1 hour. Sometimes, for a hazing event, college students have done that. I mean, there is nothing safer in the world that you and I can think of than pure, clean, cold water. Well, in excess. You can kill a person with it if he takes water too excessive. Anything excess can be lethal. So RF energy, if I happen to have a megawatt transmitter a couple of feet from me, and I sit there for a significant period of time, the total amount of RF energy that hits me is going to create heating, and that's the next thing I want to mention. RF energy, each individual photon, each individual particle, is way too low in energy to do damage. Only when you have a whole lot of them all at once can you do something. The way your microwave oven works is it's putting close to 1,000 watts of power into something that's in the vicinity of 1 cubic foot, and the RF energy there is at 2.45 gigahertz. Nothing magic about that frequency. The first water resonance frequency is around 22 gigahertz. 2.45 gigahertz was left over. It was a blank frequency no one was using at the time. It was high enough in frequency you could operate a magnetron and the microwave oven cavity with it, and so it became the frequency at which we cook our food. Almost all of the cooking of your food is thermal absorption in the water. It's the water in your food that's doing all the cooking. You put a thoroughly dry piece of bread in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water, and the glass of water is there to protect your microwave oven. You don't want the microwave oven to think it's empty, otherwise all of the RF energy is trying to pour into that cavity, comes reflecting back to the tube, and it could damage the magnetron tube. So you put a glass of water in there, and you put your dry piece of bread, and you run the microwave oven for a minute, the glass of water will get hot, the piece of bread will stay cold. Put a moist piece of bread in there, the bread will get hot. It's the water in your food that's doing the vast majority of the cooking. And it's got to be water in liquid form. Water in a frozen form doesn't do any cooking. That's why you got a defrost cycle. Won't get into that one. When it comes to cell phones emit a rather small amount of energy. I think the highest power your cell phone can go to is 3/10 of a watt, 300 milliwatts, if and only if you are at maximum distance from the cell phone base station. So the power coming out of your cell phone is directly proportional to the distance between you and the cell phone base station. Something like 700 times per second. The base station is giving orders to your cell phone, telling it to go up or down in power in order to carefully adjust it to just the right power for your particular range so that those frequencies can be reused by the rest of the system. So it's a power-managed system. And if you're really worried about trying to lower the power of your cell phone, make sure you're operating when you're close to the station. Or put repeater timer. Now, the best, most authoritative article that will tell you everything you want to know about radio frequency biohazard is called ANSI Report, A-N-S-I, American National Standards Institute, report called C-95. You Google those words, A-N-S-I, C-95. You'll get a document which has got a title that goes on for a paragraph, and it basically says these are the standards for radio frequency biohazard for the United States between 3 kilohertz and 300 gigahertz. And in there, you're going to find out what is the maximum permitted exposure and so on. All of that information in that C95 ANSI report represents 50 or 60 years of research on that subject. 450 references. Those references come from the world's best research laboratories and institutions of study and whatever. RF energy has been studied like you wouldn't believe in all of those 450 references. If you read them carefully, you'll discover that no one has found anything but thermal effects. By that I mean, when radio energy hits your body, of that portion that's absorbed, it gets turned into heat. That's all. People have thought that, hey, the signal is going to be rectified by your nerves, and it's going to be creating phony signals, and it's going to be creating a disturbance in your brain or whatever. People have worried about that for years. Haven't found it. Only thermal. Now, if I stand the right number of feet away from a 100-watt transmitter, in the worst case, if the frequency is one of those frequencies between 30 and 300 megacycles, where your body is nearly 100% absorber, how much energy you get from that 100-watt transmitter is a function of how far you are from that transmitter, inverse square law, and how much of your body area is exposed to it, how much heat you're going to absorb. It's almost identical to standing the same distance away from a 100-watt light bulb. A 100-watt ordinary incandescent light bulb is also giving off heat. That heat hits your body and creates absorption. So, is a 100-watt transmitter safe? Yes and no. Is a 100-watt light bulb safe? Depends on how close you are. If I put my eye an inch away from a 100-watt light bulb and stare into it, I'm definitely going to damage my eye. So, should we outlaw light bulbs? You see where I'm going here. It gets kind of ridiculous. The vast majority of what's going on with cell phone fear is the word RF radiation. It's vocabulary. It's a misunderstanding. The most vulnerable part of a human being to thermal energy is the human eye, because the eye doesn't have very good sensing for temperature when it's hot or cold, and it can't tolerate a whole lot of temperature without creating a cataract situation. So almost all of the standards in that ANSI report are with reference to eye damage as a potential. So now, you can't instantaneously heat your eye just like you can't instantaneously heat a pot of water. Therefore, the standard uses a 6-minute integration period. You must integrate for 6 minutes, which is 360 seconds, if I got it right? 6 minutes times 60? Yeah, I think it's 360 seconds. So, the total amount of exposure you get over a 6-minute period is the way you decide that it is or is not safe. Therefore, pulsed energy, which is only there for a very short period of time, There are people who make the mistake of trying to figure out the peak pulse power and decide whether or not it's dangerous. Well, you've got to figure out what is the average pulse power, how much empty space is there between each of those pulses. Now, when it comes to brain damage, people think that the brain is the most vulnerable organ. Without a doubt, it's the eye. The brain has an extremely prodigious flow of blood. You look at a properly oriented schematic diagram of the human brain, and you realize there's a tremendous blood flow through there, which is a beautiful cooling system. And therefore, you can pour an awful lot of RF energy into a human brain without creating any damage. Now, in the worst case situation, if I chose a person who, because of his genetics and because of what he's exposing himself to when it comes to chemistry and the foods he eats and so on, if he has a potential for developing a brain tumor, and then if I always operate with the cell phone on the right-hand side of my head, and the cell phone on the right-hand side of my head creates a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit temperature increase, because I'm always operating the cell phone as close to my head as possible at the maximum distance from the cell phone base station where the cell phone has to run at the maximum power. And now I've got a tenth of a degree increase in temperature on the right-hand side of my head, and I've got the propensity where I'm going to develop a brain tumor anyhow. Would I therefore develop the brain tumor first on the right side of the head versus the left side of the head? There was an article on that exact subject recently that got a lot of people upset because they think they see a correlation between the side of the head that a person develops a brain tumor and the side of the head where he operates the cell phone. So if a person was going to get a brain tumor and now the cell phone very slightly accelerated, whether it be on the starboard side or the port side of his head, so to speak, left or right side, you maybe could make a case for that one, but it's a very, very difficult one. The vast majority of everything you do radio-wise is a hell of a lot safer than you think it is. In order to really get yourself in trouble, you've got to be amazed at what you've got to do. So let me give you an example. I'm going to drop. I got an 80-meter dipole. I mount it 5 feet above the ground. I sit my long chair out there 5 feet away from it, and I put a kilowatt of power into it. Boy, that sounds dangerous. You go through the mathematics and you realize that the 1,000 watts of power is being radiated along the whole length of that wire, which is 131 feet long, and I'm 5 feet away from a section where I'm only looking at the 5 feet of that wire, so to speak. Second of all, 80 meters is a frequency where the vast majority of the RF energy does not get absorbed by the body. At the lower frequencies, energy goes right through a human being and doesn't stop. So the lower frequencies are safe because the energy goes through and doesn't stop. The medium frequencies, the VHF frequencies, 30 to 300, are the place where you get maximum absorption. You go up to the higher frequencies, above 1500 megs, now the so-called microwave frequencies, another crazy thing happens. 20% is absorbed and 80% is reflected off the skin. Let me repeat that. Pound for pound, microwaves are 5 to 1 safer than the VHF frequencies. Opposite of common sense. Me and the other people of the DART committee, Defend Amateur Radio Towers, have stood before various zoning boards and try to get the fact across that microwaves are 5 to 1 safer than VHF frequencies, and they think you're crazy. It doesn't make common sense. It doesn't fit the folklore that we've all told each other all of these years. There are people in certain towns on Long Island who have developed such a fear of RF energy that they want all of the antennas removed from the town. Let me drop. I know people in the town of Bayville who are very strongly requesting that every single antenna in that town be removed from the town and placed in some other town. The fact that those antennas are supporting fire, police, emergency services, cell phones, and whatever, they still want them out. And the fact that they're going to lose all those services doesn't bother them. They're absolutely positive that the RF energy from these antennas has created a problem where one person on the faculty in the school developed a cancer and one student developed a cancer. They feel that that is a cancer cluster, and there is a water tower across the street from the school containing those antennas, and therefore they say, hey, that's causing it, let's remove all those antennas. And what it's going to do to the adjacent towns, that doesn't matter. I just want them out of my town. It's a sincere group of people trying to protect their children, but they're misunderstanding the physics. They don't understand that 200 feet away is the nearest you could possibly get to one of those antennas. because the water tower is 200 feet away from the school, and it's another 150 foot high, and it's got an antenna that's aimed out to the horizon. And even if a student climbed the ladder on the water tower and stood at the perimeter of the water tower with the antennas in the middle, it's the equivalent of being the same distance away from a 100 watt light bulb. You're getting a hell of a lot more thermal heating when you lay on the beach in the summertime and the sun is shining on you at a kilowatt per square meter. So 1,000 watts is going into your body when the sun shines on you. So if you really think RF energy is unsafe, you should turn off all the light bulbs in your house. You should never allow anyone to go out in the sun. And as I was starting to tell you, there are people in the town of Bayville who will not operate their computer system with the plug-in PCMCIA card because it makes intermittent transmissions in order to connect them to the internet. So when the child is in the house, they won't turn on the computer, they won't turn on the cell phone. They won't operate a microwave oven. And they're taking it to a unreasonable extreme. And if they really think that those things have that much danger, then they should definitely turn off all the light bulbs. I think you see where I'm going in this one, Joe. You've only had a little bit of the story, but it is 99% emotion and less than 1% fact, most of what you're reading on this subject. And again, it's a problem of vocabulary. K2KYQ, K2LIW, you got it, Joe.
The comment K2KYQ.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is K2KYQ. In the United Kingdom, they put through a bill prohibiting the use of cell phones by any child under 9 years old. And you know what they based it on? Did you read what they're basing it on? Over.
Yeah, in the case of a young child where brand new cells are being developed at an extremely high rate, they have an assumption, not documented, but they have an assumption that a child is more vulnerable. So a young child talking for a long period of time on a cell phone to grandma, they think is at an increased risk. The Bureau of Radiological Protection for the United Kingdom has come up with a recommendation like that, not based on real measurement, based on a conservative approach. If you also look at the three-volume series for microwave ham radio, the three-volume series published by the Radio Society of Great Britain, on volume number 2, they recommend that ham radio operators hold their handy-talkie horizontal, even though the station is talking to it vertical, hold it horizontal so that the rubber duck is further away from your eyes. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. The testimony went in the United Kingdom that the Royal Society of Surgeons in the country testified, number the so-called upper echelon, that many cases where they've seen they claim it's been quite a rise now in brain tumors. And the person that has gotten this brain tumor, they'll find that if they're left-handed, it seems like they have more brain tumor situations on the left side. If they're right-handed, it'll be more on the right side. And they claim because the left-handed person has a tendency to hold the cell phone to the left side of his head. So they now have, pushed through this regulation that is prohibited to give a child or let a child, in public, I don't know how they enforce it, use a cell phone. Now, this is, this how these people put this together, but you see how easily they can just twist simple facts and easily put through a legislation deck. So it wouldn't surprise me if they didn't actually put through legislation and start eliminating antennas over.
Understand. I suspect that this could very well be anecdotal. In other words, if a very objective study was done of which side of the head versus left-handed and right-handed. And by the way, a right-handed person, an awful lot of the brain activity is taking place on the left side to control that right hand. So there's a peculiar kind of correlation going on there that's got to be documented. I'm having trouble believing that this is a reasonable thing to do. But when in doubt, take error on the side of conservativeness is the right thing to do. That part is smart. But when you really study the amount of heating that can be created by a cell phone under normal circumstances, it is so darn small, and the head is so darn good at dissipating the heat that I'm having trouble believing that that's really valid. Now, if you use a, either a headset or a speaker microphone equivalent with either your handsy-talkie or a cell phone, you are moving the source of antenna emission further away from your head to some other portion of the body, which can handle it much more likely. If you have the telephone clipped to your belt, now you're going to be hitting him in the stomach more than you are your head. Now there's going to be people worrying about that one. A headset connected to a cell phone. Yes, a little bit of the RF energy crawls along that wire to the headset, but that is probably 5% of what's actually being emitted by the cell phone itself. So I wouldn't worry about that one. A speaker mic on a handy-talkie does give you a little bit extra safety if you feel that this is a problem. And a headset or the Bluetooth-type hookup on your cell phone is another way to go. Although there's now going to be somebody worrying about the Bluetooth thing that's plugged into your ear, because it's putting out a couple of milliwatts and a very brief pulses, and is that going to be creating a problem? I think that when the smoke finally clears on all of this one, Joe, I think we're going to discover that we've been overly alarmed primarily by vocabulary. And so an awful lot of the worries you've got, I think, are not valid worries. But you're listening to an opinion. I'm telling you where the opinion is coming from. And if you do read the ANSI C95 report, I didn't say it's easy to read, but it's got some nice charts and graphs, and once you get through the vocabulary, it'll tell you the best source of documented information we have over the last 60 years. Let me drop. For the whole darn United States, that document is the basic document used by OSHA, the Department of Defense, NIOSH, all of your major organizations refer back to that particular document for setting our standards. The Bureau of Radiological Protection in the United Kingdom has a similar document. Each of the major European countries have a similar organization that does this kind of research, and the results do get compared between them, and they all pretty much correlate. And the bottom line is RF energy is only a thermal heating device, and if you know the watts of the transmitter, you know, the feet away from it, and you relate that to a light bulb of the same number of watts to the same number of feet away, you're getting a very close approximation to the amount of heating you're going to get to your body, and can your body tolerate that? And if the answer is no, you better never go out in the sun, now, Joe. K2KYQ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Let me make one more comment there. K2KYQ.
Go ahead, Mel.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute and say, well, look at the study, how long it took them to discover the hazards of different materials such as benzene, lead, asbestos, and so on and so forth. And look how many years before we actually, were able to determine the different items I just mentioned or a detriment to humanity. This is an argument that's put forth because all these things, well, they were around for many years, and DDT, another thing to think about, how marvelously a spray that was, how during World War II they said how much disease it prevented and all. And then we see what it has done to individuals and the environment. Are we looking at complete something maybe that right now that we can't conceive? Again, I'm playing devil's advocate because I don't really believe in radio waves as being hazardous, but is that a possible journey that we're going to go down in the future over?
No one in his right mind can say absolutely not, that's impossible. Of course, that is a possibility. However, the good news about RF energy is that it really has been sincerely studied since World War II. It started producing some very high-power radars, putting them on airplanes with pilots and co-pilots and bombardiers nearby on that airplane. And we started some very serious studies of radio frequency biohazard In other words, do human beings become injured by being near radio transmitters? We've been studying it very sincerely for approximately 60 to 65 years. In the case of asbestos, cigarettes, and other things, because large commercial organizations were involved, because no one government protection agency at the time was assigned the task of finding out whether it was safe. I mean, people have been smoking cigarettes for, I guess, well over 100 years, maybe 150, 200 years, and as such, no one agency until T. Edward Coop came along really picked up the responsibility of finding out whether or not it was safe. It wasn't really being studied. And even when it started becoming studied, because those people doing the study were interfering with an organization, a industry, which had a huge cash flow and had a lot of very expensive lawyers defending themselves, the real study got delayed for decades before the truth really came out about how dangerous cigarettes are, and until a human being who was on the inside of the organization became a whistleblower and revealed the fact that some of the cigarette manufacturers were putting chemistry into the cigarettes that increased the amount of addiction so that people would continue using the product prolifically so that more cash would flow. Until somebody on the inside, a whistleblower, came out with that information, it was very hard to find out what was really going on. You don't have that kind of a situation with radio. There isn't one company building radios like you have one major set of organizations that were selling cigarettes, so to speak. You didn't have one major company. You did have one major company building asbestos, and they were defending it. And again, no one organization had been assigned the task of studying it. So because radio has been so well studied, I think the chances of everybody missing this this dangerous phenomenon, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think it's a real long shot. That's a belief. I'm back to you, Joe. K2KYQ, K2LIW SecNet. Good question.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dick. I appreciate it. I can't believe it. I had a whole page of questions to ask you, and you answered every one of them between you and Mel. Okay, so the thing that I have to be concerned about is the thermal heating aspect of this, and that involves the eyes, and that falls back on that thing with the cops many years ago with the handheld, where you can transmit with the antenna right in front of your eyes. So I can see that. So we don't have to worry about all this other stuff. I listen to this show every night. It's called Coast to Coast. It's one of these. I guess it's patterned after the old time talk shows of many years ago. They talk about everything from this subject to what is it, Bigfoot and all that. So you get discounts 70% of what you hear on there. But every now and then you get some really interesting scientific discussions going. And this one sounded like this guy really knew what he was talking about. I wish I had a copy of his name down, but it was in the middle of the night. But you guys make better sense. Dick, thank you very much. And Mel, thanks for your comments. And I'm going to back off and sit by and listen to the rest of this interesting night. K2, KYQ.
Thank you, well. I think it was YO. Start off with your name and then your comments, sir.
Good evening, Dick. Mel is an expert.
Very fine, Bernie. Bernie, your audio is quite low. You're running about 10% of the volume of everyone else you're listening right now, and a little bit of hum in the background, which is probably your PL, which I now hear because I have to turn up my volume real loud. So you either got to talk a lot louder into the mic, or maybe you've got a little bit of a microphone problem there, which is giving you low audio. When it comes to the transmission system as opposed to the distribution system, your high tension, 130 kilovolt, 330 kilovolt, and even in some cases megavolt, DC transmission system that are on the 200-foot high towers going across farmlands and whatever, transmitting power over hundreds of miles. Those are a lot safer than you would think because, believe it or not, that is almost a shielded system. Let me explain that one. If we live long enough, we all remember back in the days when 300 ohm twin lead was the most popular kind of transmission line used between your television receiver and the aerial that was on the chimney of the house. The 300 ohm twin line really is two wires side by side with no other shield. But because the current flowing on the two wires is balanced at each instant of time, if there was a milliamp flowing up on the right-hand wire, there's a milliamp flowing down on the left-hand wire. And because the two wires are so close together as far as wavelength is concerned, that is a beautifully shielded system. You put any kind of a sensing device near twin lead that's being properly used, and it's almost as well shielded as coax. Not quite, but close. Okay, the three-wire system you've got for transmitting three-phase power on these extremely high tension lines falls into that category. 60 hertz is an extremely low frequency. Therefore, the spacing between those wires is an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. Those three wires, and by the way, the twin lead for your television set, if you wanted to, you could have made it into a three-wire system instead of a two-wire system. And not feeding the two wires 180 degrees out of phase, but feeding each of the three wires 120 degrees out of phase. And you would again have a very well-shielded system. That would be a tri-wire instead of a bi-wire system, so to speak. Well, your high-tension transmission systems are a three-wire kind of twin lead, 120 degrees phase shift between the two, and it's extremely well-shielded. So the E-field you get from that, you take an E-field probe and you walk near those wires on the farmer's land underneath those towers, and even though you know the voltage on each one of those wires is, say, for instance, 330 kilovolts to ground, and you know how many feet you are from the wire, and you stand there with your E-field probe, you would measure about 1% or less of that E-field that you would calculate on the assumption you ignore the current flowing on the other two wires. So it makes it a fairly well-shielded system, both as far as electrostatic is concerned and electromagnetic, as far as magnetic field is concerned. Let me drop. There are farmers claiming that their cows that do their grazing underneath those high-tension lines don't give the same amount of milk as they used to give before the wires were installed. And so you could easily start a rumor like that among the dairy farmers, and you would not have to work very hard to get them to all believe it. And now your real problem is how do you confirm it? And it's not an easy one to confirm, but I'm relatively sure it's not taking place. Those kind of studies were part of the studies done on that on the various references that you'll read about in the American National Standard Institute C95 report. So power line frequencies have been studied, and it turns out that they're the thresholds of alarm. I think it is something like 2 Gauss, I believe is the number, which you have to be very close to a real leaky high power transformer before you get to that kind of power. I once made a measurement in New York City of a power transformer in the base of a 22-story building, which did come up to that level when you were within 1 foot of the front panel of the transformer that fed the hold-on building. The reason I was brought into the building is because the person was using a video monitoring and video editing. The person was using some editing equipment, and he was getting some magnetic effect. And that's an unusual case where you get a faulty transformer feeding a very large building, and the person was quite close to it, and the actual magnetic field that they were getting was well within the safe region. However, the instrumentation they were using happened to be quite sensitive to magnetic fields. There was another case of a building in New York City which was being used for word processing, and a whole lot of computers were getting a strong magnetic field from the transformer that was in the basement. And in that case, the owner of the word processing company wanted Con Ed to change out the transformer, which would have been very expensive, would have been very disruptive, would have cut off the power in the building for a long period of time. They got around the problem by changing the computer program that was being used by the word processing people so that it was synchronizing the screen to the 60 cycle power, and therefore the screen wasn't dancing anymore. It takes a rather large amount of magnetic field to create disruption to human beings. Let me drop one more.